Hi, I'm Kurt Levy. I'm president of the Committee for Justice and a constitutional law attorney. Committee for Justice is sponsoring, co-sponsoring this debate with the Federalist Society, specifically its Civil Rights Practice Group, of which I'm also a member. We didn't use war on women in the name of the talk, but basically this is about the legal issues in, you know, that have come up in the war on women, as well as the political implications and the media coverage of the alleged war on women. In case any of you have been hibernating the last few months, it's been a major issue in this election campaign. Democrats have accused the GOP of waging a war on women, including many things, but on the legal side, of wanting a religious exception to the HHS Obamacare mandate that employers provide insurance that pays for contraception with no deductible. Some Republicans at least, opposed the Ledbetter Act, which passed. The Paycheck Fairness Act was more widely opposed by Republicans. That didn't pass in the Senate. It did pass in the House. I think you're all very familiar with the contraception debate, but let me quickly explain what the Ledbetter and Paycheck Fairness Acts are about. The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act grows out of a decision about 5 years ago by the Supreme Court in Ledbetter versus Goodyear, and that concerned the statute of limitations. The Supreme Court said that the 180-day statute of limitations for filing an EEOC complaint under Title VII starts running when you have your first discriminatory paycheck. Now, there may be equitable tolling, but other than that, it starts as soon as you get the first paycheck rather than with each paycheck as a discriminatory paycheck, as some people had argued. So that caused, there was a lot of furor over that decision. Lilly Ledbetter, her claims were barred because of that decision. And ultimately it led to passage of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which changed the rule. And since it was a statutory rather than constitutional ruling, Congress could overrule the court in effect and say that now the statute of limitations starts with each discriminatory paycheck. So as long as there's a gender-based disparity in pay, or actually, any illegal disparity in pay, the statute of limitations continues to be reset. I should point out there's also, at least as far as gender-based discrimination goes, there's also the option to sue under the Equal Pay Act, which has been around for about almost 50 years, and that has a bit longer statute of limitations, a 3-year statute of limitations. The Paycheck Fairness Act, as I say, was passed by the House early in Obama's term, but never by the Senate, and it was aimed at addressing the alleged male-female pay disparity. It would expand the scope of the 63 Equal Pay Act such that employers would be required to justify any gender-based disparity in pay by pointing to legitimate job-related reasons for it. So we're going to look at both of the acts I mentioned, Ledbetter and Paycheck Fairness. We'll look at the religious liberty contraception mandate issue. We'll open it up to any other war on women issues that people or the panelists are interested in. We'll ask, is there really a war on women? And finally, we'll look at the political implications and the media coverage of all this. I'm going to start out with a sort of a general question for each of the panelists. But before I do that, let me introduce them. Immediately to to my left here is, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Fatima Goss-Graves. Is that close?
You're close. It's Fatima.
Fatima. I apologize then. And Fatima works to promote the rights of women and girls in school and in the workplace. She advocates publicly and litigates on a variety of legal and policy issues, including at-risk girls in school, hostile school environments, women's participation or girls' participation in athletics, equal pay for equal work, which is very much on point with what we're discussing today. She previously worked as an appellate and trial litigator at Meyer Brown, one of the biggest law firms, and she clerked for one of the best-known Court of Appeal judges in the country, Diane Wood, on the Seventh Circuit. For any of you who don't know, Wood was on Obama's shortlist when there were Supreme Court vacancies. She may be, if Obama's reelected. Sabrina, who's on the far end, she's the executive director of the Independent Women's Forum. She recently co-authored a book with her colleague at IWF, Carrie Lucas, titled Liberty is No War on Women, How Big Government and Victim Politics Undermine America's Progress. So again, the liberty war on women issue is very much on point today. She's also managing partner of Evolving Strategies, a communications strategy firm. Prior to launching that firm, she worked in numerous communications positions, including for Senator George Voinovich, for the Republican Jewish Coalition, for the White House Writers Group. She comments on politics and political culture in many publications, as well as on TV and radio. She began her career as an assistant at the American Enterprise Institute to former UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, and she received two master's degrees from University of Virginia, one in politics and one in American history. Jennifer Braceras, who's sitting next to her, in other words, three down from me, she is a former commissioner on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, also a columnist. She was on the commission for 6 years, appointed by George Bush in 2001. She also teaches civil rights courses as an adjunct law professor at Boston College and Suffolk University. She's visiting us today from Massachusetts. She's a prolific writer. I know because I'm on her email list and I get stuff from her all the time. Her columns and longer essays are about politics, law, culture, and they've appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, and many other publications. She's also a commentator on
the Boston Herald.
And shouldn't leave out the Boston Herald. She has also been on TV a lot, ABC News and all the cable channels and NPR. She graduated magna cum laude from UMass Amherst. She's now on their board of trustees. After college, she worked for the RNC and also for VP Dan Quayle. She went on to Harvard Law School, where she served as an editor on the Harvard Law Review. After law school, she clerked on the U.S. District Court and on the Second Circuit. Then she practiced law with Ropes and Gray, specializing in employment law. And she left private law practice, I think, around the time I first met her, to do some research at Harvard Law School, be a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, and, as I mentioned, a columnist. And then last, but certainly not least, is Marcia. Two down from me. She is the founder of the, and now the co-president of the National Women's Law Center, which in some of my past litigation positions we've done battle with, but I have a great deal of respect for her, and certainly both her and Fatima get special thanks for coming into a relatively hostile environment here. She is.
No, we don't fight.
Hopefully not a hostile in the gender-based sense, but yes, not hostile at all. I hope. Anyway, she's recognized, been for a long time, really, a recognized expert on women's issues, including education, employment, health and reproductive rights, economic security. She's been a leader in the passage of major legislation, including the Ledbetter Act, which, of course, we'll discuss today. She's been a key part of Supreme Court victories, strengthening protections against sex discrimination for students and teachers. She's written a lot of articles. She's been recognized as a top lawyer by a bunch of different organizations, and has been written about by a variety of publications, you know, her career, that is. And she's really won too many awards for me to list them all before founding the National Women's Law Center under a different name about 40 years ago. She practiced with Kaplan and Drysdale here in D.C., and she received both her bachelor's and her J.D. from University of Pennsylvania, both with honors. Like I said, I'm going to start off by asking them pretty general questions. We agreed that Jennifer and Marsha will focus more on the general issue of the war on women, whereas Fatima and Sabrina will focus more on Ledbetter and the Paycheck Fairness Act, but we're not going to enforce those boundaries too tightly. I'll ask the general question in the order that we did the introductions. Please, panelists, try to limit your answer to 3 minutes. Fatima, tell us about a little more, I briefly introduced it, but a little more about the Ledbetter case, why it was important, why I assume you think it was wrongly decided by the Supreme Court, and why the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act was necessary.
Sure. Thank you, Kurt, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having us here today. I think it makes sense to sort of begin with a little bit of background about the case and what happened 5 years ago in Ledbetter versus Goodyear. You know, we're talking about a situation where Lilly Ledbetter had proved to a jury that she had been paid far less than her male co-workers who were doing the same job. And what the Supreme Court decision said was essentially that she was too late, that she should have filed this claim within the first 180 days of the pay decision. And what that in effect means for most employees is either the first 180 days from when they were first hired on the job, or for when the first time they got a raise or did not get a raise. And so, you know, you sort of put that into context and think about that being an employee's first act on the job to detect and uncover pay discrimination, I think was sort of shocking to people. Related to that, the idea that if an employer was somehow able to hide that discrimination for the 180 days, that there was no recourse, that the employer could, in effect, continue to pay the unfair wages, and that there was no remedy for the employee. I think that context is what resonated with people. And, you know, Kurt, you described it as a furor. I mean, I think there was a real, genuine outcry and really rallying cry around Lilly Ledbetter, around this case, because both because we are talking about pay discrimination, you were talking about someone losing out on real dollars and cents, but also because it just seemed unfair and inconsistent with the values both of our justice system and society. So whether you agree that there is a lot of pay discrimination, or that pay discrimination contributes a lot to the wage gap or a little to the wage gap, and I think that's something we could discuss, no one would say that Lilly Ledbetter herself, that this particular woman should not be able to recover anything. And in many ways, as Kurt pointed out, Ledbetter was bipartisan in its support. It was bipartisan in its public support, in that when the issue was polled, people supported Ledbetter, even if they identified as Republican or Democrat. And it was bipartisan in its passage, both in the House and in the Senate. And there was this great moment where the Republican and Democratic women together went down to vote in support of the Ledbetter Act. And, you know, I hope that I'll get a chance to talk more in detail about Paycheck fairness, which was also bipartisan in its support. In fact, in the House, it was more bipartisan than the Ledbetter Act when it passed. But the one really critical thing to keep in mind, because as Kurt pointed out, that, you know, Lilly Ledbetter wasn't able to bring her claim under Title VII, but there was also the Equal Pay Act. And one of the things that the Paycheck Fairness Act is trying to do is to update the 50-year-old Equal Pay Act. And part of the reason that that's necessary is because in many ways it has been watered down and less effective. And one of the things that I think is missing is sort of the right incentives so that, and I think the Paycheck Fairness Act would accomplish this, but so that employers and employees could have the really important conversations that prevent litigation in the first place. So that, employees could go and talk to their employers and say, I think I'm being paid less, or I think women may be paid less. Can you conduct a survey? Can you take a look at this issue without fearing that they're going to be fired or retaliated in some other way? So I'll stop there because I know we'll get a chance to say more, and I'm trying to take the 3 minutes seriously. But again, I'm very glad to be here.
Thank you, Fatima. Sabrina, what's your take on the Ledbetter case, the Ledbetter Act, and also Paycheck Fairness?
Well, I think that the Obama administration and women's groups generally like to tout Lilly Ledbetter as a great accomplishment for women. Very often it's talked about as a way, I think, to secure women's votes. I think that's why we did see many Republicans, they were uncomfortable with how to talk about Lilly Ledbetter. We certainly saw that with Governor Romney. They don't want to seem anti-women, but they're wrong, because the reality is that Lilly Ledbetter does not prevent discrimination. It does not prevent bad employers. It is simply extends this 180-day statute of limitations for filing an equal pay discrimination suit. And I think that we need to think about what that means, because if an employee feels as though they were discriminated, and I can concede the fact that they might not want 180 days, 6 months, they might not recognize that they're being discriminated, they may not want to come forth that quickly. But now we're saying that if they're with a company for 5 years, for 10 years, or in the case of Lilly Ledbetter, for 2 decades, they can then still file that suit for something, for a grievance that many years prior. And I think that that's something that also makes many of us very uncomfortable. Of course, it is, like I said, presumable that somebody was discriminated against, that they're going to be uncomfortable to come forward. But if we look at the Equal Pay Act, we have a 3-year deadline for that kind of willful discrimination, and a 2-year deadline for other kinds of sex-based or race-based discrimination cases. One of the things that I like to sort of emphasize is just how valuable women are to the workforce. I think very often we forget that companies are not, out to get women. The society, the workplace are not always so hostile toward women. The reality is women are outperforming men educationally and increasingly professionally, and more, in fact, this is not always a good thing, but they're increasingly becoming the breadwinners. So the reality is that women are a valuable asset, and businesses recognize that, and we need to realize that all businesses are not just looking at their bottom line and thinking, well, if I hire more women, I can get away with, lower costs. So I think that one of the most important things is to reject this idea that the workplace is so hostile toward women. I think when I listened to the bios of all of us up here today, I was thinking, wow, I'm sitting next to women who have accomplished so much, who have had all these opportunities, and who are clearly not being stopped by a society that is so aggressive toward them. Obviously, I condemned base gender discrimination. I think that we need to think about the rights of those employees who do have legitimate grievances. But I also think that we need to recognize that while there's always going to be a bad employer out there, we have to think about how something like Lilly Ledbetter will affect good employers and good employees. And the bottom line is that protective laws like Lilly Ledbetter will actually increase the cost of employing women, especially women of childbearing age, by creating the threat of lawsuits, by creating more uncertainty. And one thing to keep in mind in order to put this in perspective is that since Lilly Ledbetter passed, there really hasn't been this great demand to file suits. I think there's been about 35 suits, give or take a little bit, the website was down recently, the 35 suits that have been filed. So the idea that women are, you know, looking for some way to express their grievances, this law passed in 2009. My assumption was that there would be many, many more if this were actually something. So I think it's important to keep in mind that changing gender roles, changing technology, a vibrant marketplace, this is what has allowed women to succeed, and we don't want laws like this to actually stand in the way.
I'm going to turn to Jennifer next. Jennifer, I described some of the GOP positions that Democrats have labeled a war on women. Are Republicans hostile to women on these women's issues, you know, be it fair pay or contraception?
No. is this working? I happen to think the whole war on women catchphrase is silly, if not absurd. A lot of these issues, like the Lilly Ledbetter Act, or case and then act, are issues where reasonable people can disagree. Lilly Ledbetter was really a case about a technicality. And it was, as Sabrina said, about when the statute of limitations starts running. Now, there are strong policy arguments in favor of having a longer statute of limitations. There are strong policy arguments in favor of a shorter statute of limitations. But that doesn't mean that people who hold one position or another are interested in persecuting women in the workplace. And what the Supreme Court did in that case really was not to make policy, but to interpret a statute. It was a narrow ruling, and the court determined that Congress had intended the shorter statute of limitations to apply. Congress then reacted as it was perfectly entitled to do by changing the statute to make it reflect, you know, the policy concerns of those who felt the statute of limitations should be longer. That's how the process is meant to work. That's how the process did work. And, you know, there's nothing outwardly aggressive about that towards women. The Ledbetter case, I see it as more a case of how the legal system works and how the legal process works. The same is true, really, with the Paycheck Fairness Act, where you're really talking about things like what kind of damages can a plaintiff get? What remedies will there be for retaliation against, a whistleblower or an employee who comes forward? Those are all legitimate issues that we can talk about and should talk about. But the notion that somebody who's against legal reform in that area is somehow against women, I personally find it offensive. The same is true in many other areas. As Sabrina mentioned, women are really outperforming men in so many areas. You see it in the schools. You see it in college degrees. You see it in the workplace. I have three daughters and a son, and I see a world of opportunity for my daughters. I really don't see anything that can hold them back in terms of gender roles and gender expectations. The world really is their oyster. And, you know, that was not the case, a generation ago. But for them, it really is wide open. I don't see there as being a war on women. I think that what the so-called war on women is a political catchphrase that's intended to scare women, particularly single women. Young women who may be entering the workforce for the first time, who don't necessarily fully understand the complexity of what it's like to balance work and family yet, because they haven't gotten there yet, and the tactics are meant to scare them. Same thing with the whole birth control issue. Nobody is trying to restrict access to birth control. Sorry, that's not the case. I mean, I know George Stephanopoulos wanted to make that a big deal in the very first Republican presidential debate in January, and he succeeded in setting the tone for this campaign. But the fact of the matter is, in 2012, nobody's trying to limit access to contraception. The question is, who should pay for it? And whether it should be free, or whether, you know, religious employers or people with religious concerns about birth control should have to foot the bill. So I view it as a clash between religious liberty on the one hand and free contraception on the other. I don't view this as a war on women, but again, that catchphrase was used to try to take this issue and use it as a sword and frankly scare younger women into thinking that the big bad Republicans want to control their reproductive freedom, which is ridiculous.
Marcia, war on women is an awfully strong term. Is there really a war on women?
Well, as you know from my biography, I'm a lawyer, so I parse things probably is to my detriment if I wanted to talk in sound bites, et cetera. But I do think that there is a war on policies that are critically important to women, an attack on programs, on legal rights, on support. And I could describe a lot of different examples of how those pieces fit together. And I think Jennifer raised a very important point. One issue is, do people mean to do bad and terrible things to women? That's maybe some, but that's not usually what is motivating people. But with all other intentions, are they supporting policies, laws, interpretations, budget decisions that have an adverse effect on women? And I don't think the public draws those distinctions about whether you mean to do something that's going to be harmful to me, or you are doing something harmful to me, whether you meant it or not. If it's a policy that's important for women, and then I just want to take a minute or two to just say a few of them, then that's what is making people feel so vulnerable. And I think that pay, and Fatima raised this, is a quintessential economic issue, obviously, for women, but for their families, for all the reasons that were just said, given the importance of women in the workplace and the importance for them to support themselves and their families and in two-wage earner families, the importance of those both of those earnings to keep a family going, are things that resonate with men and women. So when the decision came down, and I just want to put one final point on it just to clarify what we mean by statute of limitations, because if this is sort of a legal discussion, it's not often things I get into, but actually for pay discrimination, there is a two-year statute of limitations in the way that you normally mean it. But there is this 180-day requirement to file a complaint with a government agency in order for you to get into court where that two-year statute of limitations applies. So in Lilly Ledbetter's case, having worked for almost two decades at Goodyear, at a job that she really needed, her family, her husband, her kids really needed. She didn't, in fact, Goodyear had a policy that you were not allowed to discuss your salary with other employees. She didn't know until she had been there for 19 years and got an anonymous note that all the men who held the same job she did over all the years that she was there, including younger men coming in for fewer years, all got paid more than she did. And then that's not just the loss of her salary. When you get overtime, it's based on your salary. When you get pension benefits and contributions, it's based on your salary. When you get raises, it's often a percentage raise based on your salary. So over a working lifetime, And when she's facing retirement, imagine how much it adds up to. So just to make clear, now you can file that 180-day, within that 180-day period for the last paycheck discrimination that you can prove you received. But you can only get your employer to go back 2 years from the time that you filed that complaint for damages, back pay, etc. So what was really at issue here was, leave those 17 years aside, can she get the last 2 years fixed? And for as long as she worked at Goodyear, would she have access to court so that they wouldn't be able to continue to discriminate against her? That's really what was at issue with Ledbetter. So you can call it a technicality. And in many ways, it's very technical when you think statute of limitation. I mean, just saying statute of limitations is technical. And 180 days and 2 years and that's all technical. But the bottom line was, if you are discriminated against in pay, as everybody has recognized, would you even know within 180 days to go file a government complaint? Would you want to go annoy, I could use a different word, your employer that soon by filing a government complaint? So, people say no, and then does this, what kind of equal pay protection is there? So I'm going to, said enough about Ledbetter that we know was central to this discussion, and leave paycheck fairness. But I just want to raise a couple of the other issues that begin to develop this pattern of what's going on here. And I will say, we don't talk about Republican, Democrat. We don't talk about Republican war on women. We get support. I've worked at this a very long time. So we would be very successful if we had Democratic blinders, Republican blinders. We're nonpartisan, and that's our approach. So we just are looking at these policies. Violence Against Women Act, up for reauthorization. Very important, using our court systems, etc. Held up. Budget proposals. While we all know that there's a lot of debate around, are we going to reduce taxes for the wealthy, for the not wealthy? Are you really talking about wealthy when you're talking about the cutoffs? But there were proposals for those who talked about the importance of making sure that there were no tax increases to eliminate the child care tax credit. At the same time, they said they didn't want any tax increases. Well, child tax credit, which can mean thousands of dollars for lower income working families. How does that square with we're not into raising taxes for anybody? And I'll just put one other one out on the table that's been the subject of litigation, and that's the Family Medical Leave Act, also wildly popular, but very limited in its application. And there are fights about, right now it only applies to employees with 50 or more employers with 50 or more employees. Fights about should it be expanded to apply more broadly. Title VII covers employers with 15 or more employees. Should there be some pay component, etc. So I'm going to stop there, but I think thinking about what are these political issues being discussed and how much they really affect women's day-to-day lives, that's, I think, where this feeling of not war on women in the sense that, oh, you hate women, but what's going on here with the policies that are so important to me? And I will be happy to talk about the contraception issue, too, which is something that we've worked quite a bit on.
Jennifer, I can see, wants to respond. Jennifer, maybe address this point, which is, okay, maybe women have made a lot of progress, and maybe some of this stuff is not necessary in your view, but what's the harm?
Well, it's not that it's not necessary. It has to do with how these issues are framed for the media. And the title of this panel is Ledbetter and Beyond, Does the Media Oversimplify Gender Issues? And my answer to that question is a resounding yes, because when Marcia and Fatima get up here and talk about these issues, and Sabrina and I get up here and talk about these issues, we could perhaps have a conversation about the best way to address these things. And we may not agree on the best way to address these things, but we could perhaps hash out a middle ground or agree to disagree. The problem is that the media gets involved and they start characterizing this as a war on women. Now, it's not simply the media. There are interest groups that do characterize this as a war on women. And there's literature and posters and cartoons out there put out by feminist groups calling this a Republican war on women. I saw a bumper sticker the other day driving down the street in Concord, Massachusetts, "Stop the Republican War on Women." So this is a deliberate messaging strategy, if you will, which you may not be hearing here in this room, where we all sound very reasonable and interested in talking about policy, but the fact is that is what's happening out there. And that is how these issues are being described. So I would take issue with Marcia's characterization that she or her allies in the feminist movement aren't creating or talking about this false war on women. They are. As for the substance, we can have that discussion, and I'm happy to have it. But to the basic question of does the media oversimplify these issues, yes. And I'll just give you an example. It's not just the media, it's the politicians, right? So we have the Democratic National Convention, and Governor Deval Patrick, governor of my home state, gets up and says, this is the president who made sure that we had equal pay for equal work. Well, guess what? We already had equal pay for equal work. We've had it since 1963, okay? The president signed a law that dealt with the statute of limitations issue that dealt with tweaking that law in one direction, one particular direction. Barack Obama did not bring us equal pay for equal work. It is unlawful in the United States of America to discriminate on the basis of sex in salaries. It has been for decades. And anybody who tells you that Republicans or conservatives somehow don't think women should be paid equally is telling you, the Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, it's simply not true. So these are all debates at the margins about tweaking statutes and, like I said, there are policy concerns on either side. But
since we did title the panel Ledbetter, I want to ask a couple of specific questions about Ledbetter, and I'm going to focus on Fatima and Sabrina, since that's sort of the role we've assigned to them. I'll pose a question to each of them now. Fatima, why was the Ledbetter Act necessary, given that there is and always has been equitable tolling of the statute of limitations available under Title VII and virtually every statute? In this particular case, the court said that it wasn't available to Lil Ledbetter because her deposition indicated that she had known about or had certainly seen evidence of the being underpaid for several years, but certainly in general, where fairness requires it, equitable tolling is available. And then I would say to Sabrina, even if equitable tolling is available, why quibble about why someone, when someone knew something? Why not just say, look, as long as you continue to discriminate in pay, you continue to be liable, stop discriminating and the statute of limitations will run. Fatima?
Great. And I think that your question in part relates to a point that Jennifer just made about, whether this was sort of a tweak or a technical fix or and what it really meant, because, you know, obviously for 50 years now, there has at least been some laws that said you have to pay fairly. But if you have laws and no ways of really enforcing them, they're sort of meaningless, right? You know, most of the people probably here are lawyers, so we know that if there are rules in place and no way to enforce and no potential remedy, in some ways it's like the rule isn't even in place at all. But in terms of why the tolling issue, why the equitable tolling wouldn't have been enough, I think the Lilly Ledbetter story itself proves the point. Because what you would have is an employer on the one hand who could continue to pay someone unfairly, basically uneven wages for men and women doing essentially the same job, while you have the employee forced to litigate over and over about how much she knew, when she knew, did she really know enough? You know, Lilly Ledbetter, did she hear a rumor over the water cooler? Is that enough to file a Title VII charge, that you heard a rumor maybe? An employee's primary job is to do their job. It isn't to investigate whether their employer is properly paying them fairly or not paying them fairly. And I think, you know, the tolling issue is still one that's out there. And, you know, one of the things in terms of the way that the Ledbetter Act has been interpreted that has been really gratifying that you see when you look at the case laws is, for the most part, it's working as it should. What you have is parties agreeing and court saying Ledbetter Act applies, claim restored. Now let's move on. Now let's move on to the merits. What you would have if there wasn't a Ledbetter Act is this whole debate on when they knew, how they knew. And the only way I could see it coming up now is if there was a situation, for example, where someone was no longer continuing to receive a discriminatory paycheck. And then you could see there may be a reasonable equitable tolling conversation about, well, did the employer actively hide that pay discrimination, and should the claim be able to be revived for other reasons? That's more consistent with the way that equitable tolling works in other parts of the civil rights law.
I'm going to go, just in the interest of time, go to Sabrina.
That this would be a good point in the discussion to sort of talk about what the basis for this law is, which is the premise of the wage gap. And I think it's important to point out that this idea that women only earn 77 cents on the dollar to every dollar that men earn is a myth. It's highly exaggerated, and we ought to be honest about that up here, because it's not just conservative groups saying this. This has become increasingly widely accepted. The reality is, if you control for any number of variables, college major, time taken out of the workforce, different kinds of jobs that you choose to go into, that the gap largely disappears. I think it goes down to about 97 cents, which is now within sort of the margin of error. And so, in fact, there have been studies that show that single urban women are actually making 8% more than their male counterparts. So all of this that we're talking about is based on this idea that women across the board are unfairly compensated. And I think it's important that we emphasize that choices and not widespread discrimination are the basis, generally speaking, for pay discrepancies. I think that's why, in fact, I spoke to numerous reporters when the claims came out that Nancy Pelosi and the White House were unfairly compensating women and their own staffs. I said, well, we don't really know anything. These are just raw numbers. I know nothing about who these employees are and what, why they would be compensated one way versus their male counterparts. And so I think that's something that we need to really emphasize before we can sort of really talk about the need for these laws, because it's all premised on, in my view, a myth.
I'm going to go back to Fatima here. Given what Sabrina just said, and given that the Ledbetter Act was passed, and given that we have the 1963 Equal Pay Act, why is the Paycheck Fairness Act even necessary?
So I probably should start by just putting what the wage gap is in a little bit more context. The 77 cent statistic is the Census Bureau's standard calculation comparing all full-time male and full-time female workers. There are other ways you can slice and dice the census data. You can look at by occupation in all but one of the 265 occupations that the Census Bureau considers, men make more than women. And people have tried to really slice and dice this in a variety of ways. And no matter how it is sliced and diced, whether you're controlling for occupation, whether you're controlling for time out of the workforce, whether you're controlling for number of hours worked in a week, whatever the reason you think it should be sliced and diced, there still is a significant part of the wage gap that cannot be explained away. But that aside, because you can't explain away the wage gap, and pay discrimination does happen, and I think you know that from the cases that occur, like Lilly Ledbetter. We know that at the Law Center from the intake we receive from people coming and saying, I'm being paid less, what do I do in the same job? The Paycheck Fairness Act was critical because although the Ledbetter Act really just put us where we were, where everyone really thought we had been for decades, that you could continue to challenge pay discrimination. Hugely important to be able to challenge it at all. Without it, you would not really be able to get into court. And so when, you know, you hear Governor Patrick saying they brought us equal pay for equal work, he was probably thinking without it, you wouldn't be able to challenge it. But the Paycheck Fairness Act is designed to move us forward. And in many, many ways, there have been loopholes judicially created in some cases, or just things that weren't anticipated by laws that were 50 years old that really need to be updated. So what Paycheck Fairness would really do is provide incentives that ensures that employers and employees could have the types of conversations about wages that are necessary to ensure that employers even recognize that they are paying unfairly. As Kurt began in his description by saying, ensuring that employers have business reasons, that they have to provide business reasons rather than any old reason for paying men and women unequal wages for doing the same job.
Tim, I'm going to interrupt and ask you, do we really want judges, though, deciding what are legitimate reasons? I mean, there's a myriad of reasons why you know, one person's paid more than another, and some may be, in our minds, unfair, but not illegal. I mean, maybe I'm paying this employee more because they're good looking, and unless they're in D.C., that's probably not illegal. Do we want judges being the ultimate deciders of what's a legitimate? You know, we all agree it shouldn't be you're a woman, therefore you're getting less. But do we want judges deciding what's a legitimate job-related reason and what isn't?
So, you know, the concept of what is a legitimate job reason isn't coming out of thin air. It's a well-understood concept grounded in, 40 years of Title VII jurisprudence where judges do make determinations. If employers are saying, oh, no, I'm not paying Jane and Jack different wages because of sex, I'm just paying it, you know, name some other reason that really is a proxy for sex, the idea that you can't really do anything about it doesn't really sit well with the whole notion behind Title VII, and it's that you cannot discriminate in the workplace. So, this isn't judges determining for a business what their business reasons are. It's judges saying you have to articulate and prove that it's a business reason. You have to have a business reason. And maybe in your job, you know, it involves all sorts of things. You know, maybe it's models or something. I don't know why beauty would, but, you know, there it may be that beauty is a part of the business reason. And so the employer should explain that.
I think Marcia's probably gone the longest here without being heard from. I know she wanted to talk about contraception, but let me pose this question to you. I'm going to guess that you view Sandra Fluke, who spoke at the DNC, as a heroine for fighting to ensure that employer-provided health insurance, you know, must include no-deductible contraception coverage, regardless of religious beliefs. But I'm sure you're aware that probably half the country you know, sees her as a symbol of the war on religion rather than the war on women, and of an entitlement society in which, let me just say it, people have, you know, come to be too demanding about what they should get for free. So tell us why it's the former and not the latter.
Well, let me start with a case, a Title VII case that was decided a number of years ago. And that was a case involving an employer who determined that as a matter of that employer's religion, it wasn't a religious employer, but that particular employer's view was that women should not be the head of their households. Their husbands should be. That was their religious belief. And we have heard that articulated by some people. It's not a common across this country belief at this point in our history. It certainly was at earlier times. But that was, and I don't question the honest felt view that it should be the man who's the head of the household. How did that translate? In the context of health insurance, that employer said, if a woman is married and has a spouse, then he, the employer, will not give her dependent coverage because it's the spouse who should be the head of the household, not her. A man working in the same job got dependent care health insurance because he was the proper head of the household. And a single woman could get coverage because there wasn't a man in the picture. Now, you could say that's a deeply held religious belief. But you could also say this woman is working, who's married, the same job, the same effort, the same number of years. Why does she not get health insurance and her married male colleague does? Well, that case was brought. It didn't get to the Supreme Court, but it did get to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals held that that is a violation of sex discrimination prohibitions of Title VII. Because really what is we're talking about here when you say entitlement society, whose money is it? When you are working in the workplace, there is a trade-off that employers make and employees make about wages and benefits. So if, as a woman, you are in a situation where employees get all prescription drugs covered, all preventive health care covered, except for contraception, whose money are we talking about? The employee's contribution and her work is giving her less, ultimately, in coverage than the male worker who's getting all of his needs covered. And so that is what Title VII has been interpreted to require way before the Affordable Care Act was passed. And what the Affordable Care Act, if I could just finish for 1 second, and what the Affordable Care Act said was preventive health care in general should be available without copays and deductibles because we think, as a matter of policy, people will be healthier. Ultimately, healthcare costs will be lower if we focus on preventive healthcare. That's the theory. You can like it, you can disagree with it. That's the theory. How does that apply to women? Well, there was a scientific, it wasn't Sandra Fluck making this up, there was a scientific body asked to determine what should be included for preventive healthcare for women, which had never been looked at before. They issued recommendations which included contraception, and so the Affordable Care Act was interpreted by HHS they adopted that along with a variety of other important screening benefits, et cetera, for women without deductibles or copays. And the administration, we would say, I don't even know where the statutory authority came from, but said that, well, for religious institutions, you don't have to cover contraception if you have an objection to it. Now, when we go back to this, are we talking about in the media the war on women or a war on the policies that women need, however you want to phrase it, there is a position being taken, bills being introduced that would say an employer for religious or moral reasons, employers that make widgets, employers that make tires, they can decide that they will exclude any benefit if they feel like it for their moral reasons or their religious reasons, including contraception. And that is what the whole notion of discrimination has been, has been addressing all these years.
Jennifer, let me just focus, just so we don't focus too much on contraception. Let's say that you don't accept that you know there's any need to have employer paid contraception, but there is this tension. There's always going to be a tension between religious liberty and civil rights laws, especially I think when it comes to reproductive issues and women's issues. What's the right way to resolve that tension?
The right way to resolve the tension is to allow religious institutions, and that doesn't just mean the Catholic Church, that means Catholic schools and Catholic charities and other religious-based institutions, to run their businesses or their institutions in a way that comports with their moral beliefs. And what the HHS mandate did was say that Catholic charities or a Catholic school has to pay for something they find morally objectionable. That's unconscionable to me. And the notion that it's somehow a war on women for a Catholic school not to pay for the teacher's contraception is insane to me. If you want your employer to cover your birth control, I have an idea. Don't work at a Catholic school. There are a lot of other schools, private and public and what have you. So if you choose to work for a Christian evangelical charity or a Catholic hospital, you're signing up to work at a place that has a certain set of religious tenets. And it's not the place to argue with those tenets. It's not the place of the employees. The employees are there to do their jobs. They're not there to argue with their employers about their philosophical beliefs. I'm sorry. So I find it a little troubling when people say that it's a war on women simply because we don't want to force Catholic hospitals to pay for birth control or abortions or things that they don't believe in. That's not to say that access to those things should be limited for people who do believe in those things. It's simply to say that we shouldn't force people with moral objections to pay for it.
Jennifer, I want to leave about 15 minutes for any audience questions. So let me ask a sort of wrap-up question. I'm going to actually give you each a shot at it, but please try to limit yourself to literally a minute. I think one thing we can agree on is that there's a lot of people who feel very strongly about these women's issues, and also a lot of people who feel very strongly about religious liberty, and a lot of them are politically active and are going to vote. So ultimately, how do you think this whole, we've gone down this road now of debating about the HHS contraception mandate. I don't mean just here, but nationally. How is this ultimately going to cut in the election, and why don't we just go start at that side of the table and go down?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Kirk, because I think that, frankly, all of this discussion we're having about the war on women, there is a serious political impetus for that, and that's the 2010 midterm elections when Republicans did manage to narrowly close the gender gap for the first time in 20 years. And if it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now, because I don't truly believe that this administration is so committed to women's rights that we would be talking about the Paycheck Fairness Act and Lilly Ledbetter and the HHS mandate and all of the rest that we've discussed here today. The reality is that women are not a homogenous voting bloc. We are, you know, single, married, urban, rural, with children, without children. The idea that one political party is openly hostile to more than 50% of the electorate is absurd. I don't think you need to be a political scientist to know that. I think if you look at the 2008 numbers, it tells you a lot, and it gives you some insight into why we're having this conversation. The reality is that McCain won married women by a four-point margin. Married women are the largest voting bloc of female voters. The problem for McCain was that Obama won single women by a 45-point margin, 72 to 27. That has been the basis for Sandra Fluke, for the war on women, for the life of Julia. And I think that that is an honest conversation of what's happening here. The Democrats have had to invest a lot of political capital shoring up that core constituency. And, you know, if I were a single woman, I'm not, I'm married with three children, but if I were a single woman, I would be looking at my lawmakers and thinking, do you really think I need government help from the time I'm born until retirement? That is the
image. I'm
going to
try to enforce the limit here just to leave time for Q&A from the audience. Jennifer?
Well, I agree with Sabrina. I think it's highly political, although I would disagree that we might not be talking about it at all, because I think the catchphrase war on women has been used sort of for several decades to demonize people who oppose the feminist agenda. But we have brought it into sharper focus in this election for exactly the reason Sabrina just said, which is that, you know, a lot of pollsters believe that women will decide this election. And so rather than talk about big issues like the economy and foreign policy, we are left to debate whether Sandra Fluke should have her birth control paid for by her school and her employer. I mean, it's ludicrous, but that is what this is about.
Marcia, how's it going to cut? Religious liberty constituency versus women's issues constituency?
Two quick points. The polls, as everybody in this room I'm sure knows, depend very largely on how the questions are asked. Polls that I have seen have shown overwhelming support for women to be able to get contraception included in their health insurance, just like men have all of their prescription drug needs covered. That's number one. Number two, with respect to why, especially Sandra Fluke, absolutely skyrocketed in public attention, wasn't so much the issue, which hadn't, you know, was kind of percolating along, but when there was a hearing in the House on this issue, the minority asked that she be able to testify. And the majority said no, because she doesn't have anything relevant to bring. And as a Georgetown law student, she was the head of a student organization, and she was talking about the effect in a school on students and their health that go beyond reproductive health care per se, and the need for contraception, and why the costs can be prohibitive for women to have to pay that out-of-pocket cost themselves. So, will it have an effect on the election? I'm not a predictor of elections, so I don't know. But I do think that the fact that there was, as a result of her being barred from testifying because she had nothing relevant to bring to the table, which is what the lawmaker said, and that there were no women on the panel discussing contraceptive coverage, you know, let's get real. That makes people angry. And that is why she was there to testify, not to be a public figure, but to tell her version of the story.
Fatima, I just want
to say one other very quick thing. When the media, talk about the media, then picks up on her and starts talking about she's a slut and she's gotta, you know, we should watch her and what she's doing if we're gonna pay for her contraception. And she is a terrible human being. And all of this, that's media. And that's when she became, as a just graduated law student who stood up for her rights as despite the onslaught, that's when she became a public figure.
I have two sentences for
you. Sure.
And that is that the issues that we are talking about are not just women's issues. They're not just issues that affect single women. They are issues that are central to the economy because whether you have fair pay is a dollars and cents issue for you and your family. And whether you have access to health care is a dollars and cents issue for you and your family.
All right. Thank you all for discussing the political implications. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Hunker. I'm with the Cato Institute. One of the observations I've had by studying women's issues is that a lot of the, not suppression, but the very least, exclusion of women seems to come not necessarily from maliciousness, but almost an overprotectiveness that society has towards women that can come across as quite patronizing, which is why I kind of have concern over the HHS contraception mandate and some other types of entitlement programs. Because what it seems to say is that a woman cannot voluntarily engage in contract and negotiations with her employer, that she's not smart enough to decide whether or not she values going to, let's say, Georgetown Law School, which is a known Catholic institution, but a very renowned law school, and perhaps sacrificing as a trade-off contraception. And so I just was hoping maybe a couple of the panelists could talk about, you know, how do you support or continue these type of programs when they sort of reinforce the idea that women can't stand up for themselves and their own interests.
Let's give either Marsha or Fatima the first shot at it, and then.
I would like to take a step back because the notion that individual law students are going to be able to determine the contract that that an institution has with its health plan on their own. It's just not how the healthcare system.
It's just not how the healthcare system works.
But beyond that, I think it sets up the fundamental issue that we've been talking about today about the core protection, the core civil rights protections. So it's only women that have to make the choice that either you are enduring this form of discrimination that men don't have to endure, or go somewhere else. And I would posit that there is another way to deal with that, and that is the way that we have been dealing with civil rights over the last 50 years.
Jennifer, and maybe you could also address, do men have to make the same hard choices?
I think everybody has to make choices, and I think the point that you hit on is that there are consequences to choices we make. And you know, I say it to my kids all the time. Choices have consequences, and life isn't fair. And, you know, you have to try to make good decisions and deal with the outcome the best way you can. The fact of the matter is all of these issues have a lot to do with choice, right? So when we talk about the pay gap, a large portion of the pay gap, the so-called pay gap, is there because women take time out of the workforce to raise children. Or they go part-time, or they go flex-time, and they're not working the same hours on average as men, who tend to be the primary breadwinners in our society for whatever reason. My background is in law, so I look at major law firms, and you constantly hear claims that there aren't enough female partners, And it is true that the percentage of female partners is tiny in comparison to the percentage of females graduating from our nation's law schools. But a funny thing happens between graduation and partnership decisions, and that is that women get married and have children. And they make decisions about quality of life that affect the level at which their they're paid and compensated, and they affect the partnership track. Now, the truth is there is so much attrition among women at major law firms that I would argue if you stay the course, if you are a woman who stays the course at a big law firm and you stick it out, your chances of making partner are probably five times that of a man you come up against, because the law firms are so desperate for female partners, not just because they genuinely want diversity in their workforces, which they do, but also because the clients now demand it. The clients will demand that you staff a case with a certain number of women and minorities. And law firms don't have enough women to meet those client demands. Now, that raises a whole other set of legal issues that I'm sure Kurt could put together a very big panel on. But the fact of the matter is, all of life's outcomes are a result of choices we make. It's not always because of discrimination, and it's not always because of unfairness.
Here's a interject a quick question here myself. Here's another women's issue, affirmative action. We just had a huge case concerning race-based affirmative action yesterday, but there's also gender-based affirmative action. In just a minute, I'll ask Sabrina and I'll ask Marcia, should there be preferences for women at law firms? Let's assume there's not overt discrimination. Should there be preferences to achieve a proportional gender balance? Marcia?
Well, I don't know what you mean by preferences, but I do want to go back for a second and just give you what I was thinking, Jennifer, as you were talking about there being not always discrimination. Of course, that's true. The issue is what happens when there is discrimination. I think we're past a point where we would say to somebody who's African American, a company should be able to discriminate against you in employment, and if you don't like it, work someplace else. Just go find a job someplace else. That wouldn't be acceptable. Our civil rights laws, including the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Title VII, says people on the basis of their gender as well. If they're being discriminated against in pay or whatever, we're not going to say, well, then if you don't like it, that your employer wants to pay you less, go someplace else.
I'm going to stop you there.
And so, contraception, in our view, is not an entitlement. For most of the women, they have earned it. They have paid for it. They have paid for their insurance. This is their money. And whose religious freedom are we talking about? When you say there's no effort to limit access, what happens if it's not covered? It limits access, and that is the religious freedom of the individual woman to be able to choose and decide, given her family and personal circumstances, if she needs contraception for medical reasons, to prevent pregnancy, etc. Does she not want to have about 12 children over her lifetime, which would happen with all of the health and economic consequences if she doesn't use contraception? Those are her religious moral principles, and she earned it.
It's $10 at Walmart. Yeah. I don't understand why this has become the pressing civil rights issue of the day.
I just want to, it may be symbolic, but Sabrina, I just want to get back to that question about, is it important to have the right, since we are almost all lawyers in this room, is it important to have the right gender balance at law firms? Please try to limit it to a minute, and then we'll take another question from the audience.
I may be the only non-lawyer in the room, and from what I understand, the law is actually a pretty brutal area for women because the hours are so demanding, and you are expected to be in the office, and there's less opportunity, from my understanding and from reports on NPR, that for women to have that kind of flexible work environment. That being said, I am completely opposed to any kind of quotas or affirmative action, if you want to call it that. I think the biggest thing to point out is that men and women are different. I don't really need to point that out. We were talking about it at lunch. But today, apparently, equality is not good enough. It's not good enough that women have the opportunity to go to Georgetown Law and then to go on to clerk for the very best judges and to go on to the best law firms. Now we need to have parity, too. And it's not just in law. It's in business. It's in politics. That's a question that comes up over and over again, the fact that we have a sort of an underrepresentation of women in political office. But I think that we need to make sure that we are not sort of confusing equality with parity and recognize that men and women are going to make different choices and that not all men want to be a partner in a law firm.
Fatima wants 60 seconds here.
Just 60 seconds. I'd really encourage people to look at the ABA studies that have looked at the issues around women in law firms, that had looked at the pay differences among partners who had and hadn't taken time out from the workforce, and that had looked at some of the barriers, including that, you know, there's a whole set of informal mentoring that happens that women were basically excluded from. And so some of what you might be seeing is that law firms are trying to put formal processes in place to address and counter a lot of the informal old boys stuff that was going on.
I saw a hand raised there.
My question is kind of long. If there's somebody who has a short question.
Short question.
Excellent discussion. This is a question slash comment. I'm Hispanic, Mexican-American, Catholic. I paid for my own birth control, went to Catholic law school. Wasn't expensive at all. I didn't understand the issue either. Now I'm facing infertility. I take birth control. I go to church every Sunday. I don't understand the issue concerning Sandra Fluck. It makes me very, very angry. I think the media is talking down to me. I really want to understand why they're using this as a pretext to attack my religion when I have a choice of whether I want to work at a Catholic institution or school or not. That is, by and large, helping a lot of Latina women, low-income Latina women, and a lot of undocumented women at the local level. I'll look at the ABA studies when it comes to equal pay, but I want people to go down on the ground and look at the people in my community, the people that are being served by faith-based organizations that many, many times are being attacked by these so-called nonprofit groups that are in close coordination with the White House and are part of the minions that are actually stopping services and putting Catholic and faith-based institutions out of the business of helping people that really need help. Can you please comment?
Either Marsha or Fatima?
Well, I'll say two quick things. First of all, with respect to cost, it doesn't cost, you know, maybe it costs $10 each month, but you can, and maybe a number of people in this room could think, okay, $10 times 12, what's the big deal? That's $120. And then there's the cost of the doctor's visit to get the prescription. And then there are, for some women, that $10 prescription is not the best method for her health. And so there are other methods that may be actually cheaper in the long run, but cost $500 or $600 or $700 in the outset, and then they're longer lasting. A lot of women can't come up with $500 or $600 or $700 at one shot, plus the cost of a doctor's visit. So that's part of the dollars and cents we're talking about. And with respect to, so when you say what's the big deal because it's $10, some people it may not be that big a deal, but for many people it is a big deal. The second thing I want to say is respect for religious institutions. And that's obviously very serious. And it's beyond doubt that they play a crucial role in many people's lives individually and what happens to them and the services they provide to a community. One of the things that has applied with respect to this contraceptive coverage requirement, which, by the way, actually doesn't really cost anything because when it's been added to insurance plans, the premiums don't go up because of the normally contraception for every dollar is spent, it saves $3, and that's within the first year. So when we're talking about costs, that's a little bit skewed. But okay. Right now, the policy is, which is still open to being reviewed, religiously controlled institutions do not have to provide contraceptive coverage. And there is a debate about what about institutions that aren't religiously controlled? Do they have to? Or what about institutions that are willing to do it for their employees but not their students if they are educational institutions? What's the distinction there as a matter of religion or principle? Because that happens with some of the institutions.
We're past two now.
And
so,
I just want to say one last thing. I know I am, but the big dispute is really not Catholic institutions and Catholic schools. The big dispute is private, for-profit companies of what, you know, anything they make, that can they, for their own moral or religious beliefs, they're not Catholic institutions. They're just individual people. Can they decide women who work for them don't get this benefit?
Sabrina, take 2 minutes, and then we'll have to wrap. We'll have to end it.
I mean, ultimately, all of this, and I appreciate your question, because all of this encapsulates one larger question, which is, what is the proper role of government? And should government be in the position of providing women with their birth control, all women? And we're not talking simply about low-income women. That's why I think there was so much eyebrow raising at Sandra Fluck. And I think you point out something else that's very important, which is that as government grows, it pushes out the civic and religious institutions that otherwise fill those very important roles in society, namely helping low-income families and single women and in a host of different ways, whether it's through healthcare or providing shelter or any number of things. And sometimes I think when we have this conversation, we forget that if government doesn't do it, it's not that nobody else would step up to the plate. The reality is we have all sorts of organizations in place that will be crowded out by government intervention.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I found it extremely interesting, and I want to thank all the panelists, Sabrina, Jennifer, Marcia, Fatima, for making it so interesting. I hope you all found it equally interesting. Thanks for coming.